Decided tonight because of the we're going to be more restricted on time tomorrow to deal with human evolution, the theory of human evolution, which is really my field in a more particular way than I've dealt with evolution in general. Yes, these charts, you don't have to see be up right up on top of these charts. I regret that they're so small. I don't know any way to. I've been trying to work on a way to put them on overhead, but. I urge you to move up if you would like to, as close as you can. Now, I think you can, well, it won't have to be on top of them, but I'll make reference to them. We're not that heavily dependent upon them. Come to human evolution. The arguments for human evolution, just to sort of introduce the subject and get us into it, there are four primary arguments for human evolution. I'm only going to deal with one of the four tonight, human fossil evidence, because we don't have a whole quarter to lecture on it. Basically, I would say there's the argument from morphology or comparative anatomy. We're going to look a little bit at that to compare dentition. It's called compare the shape of the teeth, to compare skulls, old and new. Cranial, there's dentition, they divide it into dentition, cranial, shape of the skull, postcranial, everything from the skull down. Then there is comparisons made on the basis of behavior, tool making, cooperative behavior, sustained motivation, sexual and mating habits, and some have suggested even language. Didn't get very far. The argument from behavior. There's the argument from biochemistry, and I'm not going to get into that, except I'm going to say something about it tomorrow evening. What's the direction of the new arguments from biochemistry, and then fossil evidence. Fossil evidence being the hardest evidence, the most important. And so, as I say, we're not going to deal with morphology, behavior, or biochemistry. We're going to deal only with fossil evidence. So I say that so you'll know we're not dealing with the whole range of the argument for human evolution, the arguments about human evolution. I would next look at the big picture, look at it generally. First thing I would say in looking at the big picture is I would point to the general absence of human fossil evidence. This is a very significant thing. The reasons given for the absence of transitional fossils for the lower animals do not apply to human evolution. It's one thing to say, well, we can't find the transitional fossils of brachiopods. Why? Well, they were so long ago and so much has happened. But that argument does not apply to human evolution. And we are going to survey tonight, and there isn't much evidence, the fruit of 100 years of strenuous effort. If anybody ever wanted to prove anything, the anthropologists have wanted to prove human evolution. Now, by the way, You could stack up here on this little corner of the stage all the evidence that exists for human evolution. It isn't very much and hard to deal with. There's not the large amounts of evidence. Now, except unless you take Gould's theory, you recall my discussion this afternoon, who says there isn't any evidence of transitional forms. He does away with the problem by simply Gould's represent over here. He simply says, man made these humongous leaps. He doesn't need all these transitional forms. The next thing, looking at the big picture, so what I'm saying is there is the significant dearth of fossil evidence when there should be much. It's interesting. You can find all kinds of fossils for brachiopods, which were supposed to have existed several million years ago, supposed to have existed then, and men are in recent time, and find almost nothing, comparatively speaking. Second is that as with the others, I've tried to point out that the moving power behind the development of the general theory of evolution, or the theory of general evolution, trans-specific macroevolution, has been a philosophical drive, not a scientific drive. The philosophy has not been formed because men were driven by the evidence. Men were driven by the philosophy to find evidence. So much of it is untrustworthy. I'll give an example. This is a standard upper-level book written by the Godfathers, Ashley Brace and C. Lauren Brace and Ashley Montague. They are two of the godfathers of evolution in the area of human evolution, anthropologists. They say this, and it's in this book, I'm quoting it here. Use it to read. Ever since human evolution has been accepted as a fact, and the discovery of hominid fossils has been taken as documentation for this fact, there has been an expectation that the earlier stages of the fossil evidence should show a convergence with the pongid form. Pongid means chimpanzees, gorillas, from which the human line is thought to have diverged. Such expectations, however, have only been given substance in slow and piecemeal fashion. He says, look at the progression. We accept it as a fact. Then we went looking, and we thought we'd find all kinds of evidence of this common ancestry of pongid and hominid, man and what we call sometimes call apes. Boy says, it's in spite of the efforts, 100 years of strenuous effort, a lot of money. In spite of all this effort, what he's saying is it's been given substance in slow and piecemeal fashion. Haven't found much. For instance, in spite of the efforts to portray the stance of Neanderthals as semi-erect and of apocryphal accounts of projecting canine teeth and opposable great toes, it is now clear that Neanderthals do not differ enough from modern humans to warrant assignment to a separate species. I'll just sort of break into the evidence to show what he's talking about. Now, it's very significant. I just got to know what's going on. He says, he admits, he's not ashamed of it, that with Neanderthal man, Neander means, he's named that, that's German for the Neander Valley. Tall is the German word for valley. Skulls found in the Neander Valley in Germany. He admits there was, number one, tinkering with the evidence, number two, outright lying. For instance, it was published he had canine teeth originally, and opposable great toes. He could climb, he could grasp with his toes to make him more like a great ape. And it wasn't true. He said, in spite of the efforts to portray the stance of Neanderthal as semi-erect and the apocryphal accounts of, you know, follow me, the false accounts of canine teeth, despite all that, it's clear now that Neanderthal was just one of us. Now, my question is, let me show you the nature. The question is, why would they do that? Does that sound scientific? The efforts to picture him as much. Well, you see, what he's admitting is that they tinkered with the evidence to support the theory. But you see, theories are supposed to emerge from evidence initially. Hypotheses are supposed to emerge from evidence, not the other way around. But to have some basis for it. There was every attempt to show Neanderthal as being very ape-like because it would fit the scheme better. It's a real admission. Now, by the way, this is an interesting article in Science 81 magazine. This is the latest construction of Neanderthal. Put him in a business suit and you can take him out for lunch. By the way, can you see that? What they did was, they're trying to be honest. He looks a little worse. Can you see that? He looks a little worse than he would, because if he had hair on him, he would look much more civilized than he does. Because they were trying to be honest and not show any hair, because they don't really know. You know, so this is the latest construction of Neanderthal. Man, he said, now, they're kind of feeling bad. Guess what this is? Time lock. What will we do about time lock? This is Neanderthal in time life. Can you see this? Yeah, I'll go slowly. Looks like something from the zoo. This is Neanderthal in time life. This is what gets on television. It's the popular version. This is the latest thinking. That's different, isn't it? Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the world of science. The difference here is not that there's anything scientific about this, but you get two sets of artists in the world. We spent a great deal of time in the philosophy department. The social sciences now are in the art department. You see, it depends on how you think about it. Now, that's what he's talking about. And the point I'm making, want to make, and not making it very well, is that there has been, in other words, I don't trust in a court of law, you don't trust somebody whose testimony, who gives a testimony about something in which they have a vested interest. It taints the testimony. And they freely admit that we decided a man must have evolved, and there has been a desperate search, and the evidence has, there's been more dishonesty in human evolution than any other area of evolution. Do you realize that the Piltdown Man, you don't know about that? This was a hoax. Some students over in England jimmied up some evidence and buried it, and where it would be found. The Piltdown Man was published in textbooks 40 years after the hoax had been exposed. Think about it. For a whole generation, for 40 years after the hoax had been exposed, Piltdown Man was still being published in textbooks. Why? Well, it sure made good evidence, even if it wasn't true. So there has been a philosophical prejudice, which really Montague is admitting. He doesn't know he's admitting it, but there has been a philosophical prejudice. There has been, next, in looking at the big picture, the creation of evidence by labeling, which I've already suggested, Greek and Latin classifications. You find this skull and you call it hominid, and all of a sudden it becomes respectable. You call it Pithecanthropus, which is Greek for southern ape. Pithecanthropus means ape man. You get Australopithecine, southern ape. But if you just say, I found a skull, I found a monkey skull, you know, something 4 foot high, it doesn't sound as good as when you say, I found an example of Australopithecine habilis, which is very close to Australopithecine gracile, and it's, you sort of give it a Latin name and all of a sudden it becomes important. Then the next thing I say about the big picture, that the general practice that's been followed is, just like the neo-Darwinists extrapolate their way across the gaps between microevolution to macroevolution, so the reconstruction of skulls has been based upon extrapolation. Well, what is the principle guiding extrapolation? You find a fraction of a jaw, you can build the rest of the head. Based upon what? Well, based upon the fact that we know, heard that before, we know that walking upright, if the animal walked upright, then its jaw had developed to a certain length. If his skull set so far forward on the spinal column, then we know that the upper brow would have been developed so far. They got this mathematical formula worked out. So they can reconstruct a whole skull from a single tooth. And they've done that. Or find the fragments that would fit in a teaspoon and develop a whole race of men from it. Now, modern anthropologists among themselves are embarrassed by that. It never gets in the textbooks. The general picture of human evolution that's been in the textbook up till now is generally fraudulent. I do not know of a single godfather among the evolutionists in the field of anthropology who would subscribe to it. Because now they got a very interesting system. I found this when I was about knee-deep in the system, that when they sometimes would find skeletons that didn't fit the pattern, that is, they were walking, seemed to be walking upright, or were still on all fours, and the jaw had not properly developed, then they developed an interesting theory called mosaic evolution. Now, if they just find, and they've done this, and I'm not being unkind, this is exactly what has happened, and still happening a little bit. They find just a fragment of a jaw, then they say, well, we can extrapolate, we can reconstruct the rest of it because we know how it would have looked. But when they find a skull that is shaped wrong, that is too modern for its own good, for instance, appears out of order, we're going to talk about that a little bit later, then they say, aha, this is an example of mosaic evolution, where one part of the skull, for instance, the teeth flattened out ahead of schedule and the brain case rounded out a little bit later. And that's what you call heads I win and tails you lose. That is, we know exactly how it's going to look if we want to extrapolate from a tooth, but if we find a skull that doesn't fit, then we say, well, this really is an anomaly. This is why we got mosaic evolution. That is, uneven parts of the skull, parts of the man, really, evolving at a different rate. That's why it didn't look like it was supposed to look. So they had the basic scheme all worked out before they ever went digging. And so that's very convenient, by the way, you see. If you by following that program, extrapolating on the little pieces and redefining the big pieces, there isn't any piece of evidence that won't fit. It's sort of like plastic evidence. You just squeeze it and it fits right in. Now, and then there has been a gross misrepresentation. Now I'm going to talk a bit about this. I have over here a chart that shows, this is the chart that diagrams the current the current theory of evolution as it is. Now, the different lines, you can see this closely, the different lines that go here represent different evolutionists and their theory and their tracing of the line of descent. Some would say, well, this was up to man, this is modern man up here. Some say, well, it started here, the line to man went this way. Some say, no, the line to man went this way. Some say, no, the line, we don't know where the line to man started here. It went over here, and then over here, and then back up this way. See, it depends on which one you're looking at. Now, what we have here is the time life presentation. I want to talk about the visual effect. You young people, say this early before you go to sleep. You should listen very closely to this. Now, what this is, I have made a photocopy of this chart that appears in the time life. I've just, because it's on two sides of one page, I didn't want to tear up the book. I just photocopied it and glued it together, taped it together, and that's what we've got. Now, are you close enough to see any of this? See what it is? You've got this little, it's called Pliopithecus. Looks something like a chimpanzee. And look what it says. The road to Homo sapiens. Now, Homo sapiens means, it's Latin. A sapiens is the Latin word for knowledge or wisdom. Wise man. What they mean is thinking man. It looks very impressive. The road to Homo sapiens. And then it starts out here, and you got Proconsul and Diropithecus, Noeopithecus, Ramapithecus, Australopithecus. Is that respectable, that sound? Notice the gradual progression. They actually get bigger generally, and they give him a club, and then they go along here, and then they give him a spear. Then you got modern man. That has a tremendous effect on young people. Can you not see how it would? It is designed for this visual effect. And it looks very, and you follow me? You put the combination of the time chart up here and the Latin and Greek names. And it's very impressive. This is what appears on the TV. This is the general presentation. Have you all seen it before? Now, what I would like to say about this is that this is not, and again, this has nothing to do with creation, what I'm going to say now. This canceled out creation. From the viewpoint of the anthropologist, remember I've taught you this weekend there's a difference between textbook evolution, that which is for the popular consumption, and what the Godfathers really believe. This is an absolute fraud, not from a creationist point of view, simply. This is a fraud from the evolutionist point of view. There is not a, although it was written by Howe, the University of Chicago, he giggles when he sees it because he would never, ever defend this among his colleagues. He said, well, we just sort of put this together for the kids. It's exactly their attitude. Because, for instance, you can study Howe, he has written elsewhere, and see, he does not subscribe to this. Now, it is pure propaganda. It's for the visual effect, and it is very convincing, especially to young people. I'll analyze it for you. We look at it like this. First of all, if you just look at it closely, you ready for the first one? Here we have Pliopithecus, this little monkey. He's a brachy eater, and a limb swinger. See his hands like this. I'm going to read this to you. Ready? One of the earliest proto-apes, Pliopithecus, had the look of a modern gibbon, although its arms were not as disproportionately long and specialized for swinging through the trees. On the basis of its teeth and skull, it is now classed as an ancestor of the gibbon line. It's probably true. It is an ancestor of the gibbon line. My question is, what's it doing in this line? The rascal got in the wrong line. He's on the road. He's on the road to Homo sapiens. But doesn't he look nice there? Doesn't he just sort of fit in? These three creatures are just what they look like. Small apes. Proconsul, a very early ape, he is, quote, the ancestor of the chimpanzee. Now what's he doing in this line? One leads to the gibbon, the modern gibbon. One leads to the chimpanzee. What's he doing on the road to Homo sapiens? By now you figured out what he's doing there. He's there to lend to the visual effect. Then you got Rhomopithecus. Well, let me get ahead of myself. Rhomopithecus, he is viewed as being ancestral to man. Now, Rhomopithecus is right here, viewed by some as being ancestral to man. But the interesting thing is, you see how they're pictured here? This one's donut, this one's knuckle walking, this one's upright, this is a little more upright, Rhomopithecus. As a matter of fact, geologically speaking, no matter when you date them, these are contemporaries. They did not exist one after the other. One did not evolve from the other. They existed at the same time. But by lining them up and putting the first one down, bending the first one over, lining them up, it gives the impression that one evolved from the other. Does it not? That's what it's supposed to give. But you understand? They are contemporaries. Then we've got... So these two don't belong in line. This one doesn't belong in line. This one is a branch. He doesn't. He's considered a branch. He branched off, so he's not on the. So these four don't belong in line. The first time you get one, even now, you follow me? I'm not talking from a Bible point. I'm not talking from my point of view. I'm talking from the evolutionist point of view. The first four don't even belong there. They are not. They have nothing to do with the evolution of man. Understand? Nothing to do with the evolution of man. This one, according to some anthropologists, not most, but some does, so we'll let him stand in line. But it's interesting, he's called an aberrant ape. That is, he should be pictured like this. He's a knuckle walker. But you stand him up, you see why. Well, they put him that far in line, you've got to stand him up. Then there is a gap. There should be something right here that isn't there. His name is Gigantopithecus. The reason he isn't there is he's 9 feet tall. Found this evidence of an ape, which fits back here. He's 9 feet tall. He's right over here, by the way, on the chart. Why didn't he get in line? How come this poor old Gigantopithecus got left out and the rest of them got put in? And there's better fossil evidence for him than for two of these. The answer is he would mess up the picture. You know, you go along, whoop, you know, and then back it this way. So we left Gigantopithecus. What they did was, because he messed up the visual effect, they left Gigantopithecus in the footnotes. Really, and I tell you, if he were here, he would not like it because he could whip the whole bunch. Then we go to Australopithecine, southern ape man. Australopithecus, the southern ape. Now, it shows him carrying a stone, but really it's a knuckle walker, like a chimpanzee. That's not honest. This is general classification right here, Australopithecine, southern apes. They got Paranthropus, and advanced Australopithecus. This is this one and this one. Except if you were up here and could look closely, you would see that this one appears here, and this one appears here. What I'm saying is, in time, according to their system, according to the books, they're out of order. They've changed places. And it's a real problem because this one represents devolution. He's going the wrong direction. He's more like an ape. Well, he's more like an ape than this one is like an ape, but he came later. The rascal didn't have the sense to show up on the charts when he was supposed to. He came along about 500,000 years too late. But that never stopped time live. They simply changed positions in the time chart. Why? Because you see how this, he looked, if you can't look close, he has a heavier jaw.
And by the way, these are all knuckle walkers.
To show them standing up
and carrying a club
is absolutely dishonest.
So we got four don't belong there.
One who doesn't belong there, who should be there and isn't, according to their theory. Understand? I'm not talking about from a biblical point of view again.
Two out of order. This is homo erectus, and this is a question mark
because the evidence. I'll tell you why it's a question mark. Well, I'll tell you why it's a question mark. This represents Java man mainly and Peking man, which the evidence is very questionable. It was from the earliest evidence found. Java man was constructed from the piece of a jawbone. Peking man, the fossils were found in China when the war was over, and the scientific world plaster casts were circulated all over the world, but none of the original fossils. The scientists couldn't wait for the Second World War to end, so they'd get into China and see the fossils, and then it was over. Lo and behold, the fossils disappeared. None of the artifacts disappeared, none of the plaster casts disappeared, just the original fossils. They had a real problem to clear up because Teilhard de Chardin, the French anthropologist, had published descriptions of the original fossils, and lo and behold, they didn't fit the plaster casts that were supposed to be made of the fossils. And then to beat all that, because they're roughly like man is supposed to be, it's real questionable evidence, there were three different versions to explain the conditions under which they were found. Well, then what happened was, Leakey made his famous 1470 skull called Adam, which was found under more scientific conditions than Java man and Peking man, and lo and behold, it was just about the same as Homo erectus, up here, but it's supposed to come back here. That is, he found skull 1470, which is obviously a human skull, and that's very nice to find. It's a very old human skull, pre-flood human skull. The problem was, they already had their nice little system worked out, and to go trace this way, and lo and behold, according to this is some of the earliest evidence found, is questionable evidence of a Homo erectus. He's supposed to be over here, and lo and behold, they found evidence of man at that stage of development, according to the theory, way down here. That's why, when he found that skull, every anthropology text written in the world from a evolutionary point of view became fundamentally worthless. Several PhD dissertations were not worth the paper they were written on. When I moved down from Cincinnati, the chairman of the anthropology department at the University of Cincinnati was on the verge of suicide. Let me read something to you. I just happened to think of this. I think I've got it with me. It's worth the wait. This was published in the Cincinnati Inquirer when Leakey found Skull 1470. Scientists find to shake archaeology to its roots. And let me read some excerpts. It says, because of him, 1470, which is a human skull, because of him, every single book on anthropology, every article on the evolution of man, every drawing of man's family tree will have to be junked. They're all apparently wrong. By the way, they're still being printed. They're still being printed. The same old scheme, but that's the old story. A lot of people were skeptical, as I was, when he first announced this. He's interviewing an anthropologist from the University of Cincinnati. Because there's 40 years of work and hundreds of fossils that back the other plan, this traditional one. You understand? It just came in all in the wrong place. You talk about the forgery, the Piltdown man, which was a famous scientific forgery, but this is no forgery. This is the real thing. There's no question about it. Now, I'm quoting now. Listen. We just don't know what the hell happened. There's no real theories. Everybody's sort of astounded. It just throws us back to go. My apologies for the crude language. I'm quoting. Now listen, young people, what that means is, what they're saying is the basic scheme, the basic development, the basic program showing human evolution that was in the textbook since the 1910, since 1910, 1915, is now totally unworkable. The very one about which it was said, well, if you don't accept this, you're just not scientific. And it must have been very fragile if the finding of a single skull could scrap the whole business. It has been scrapped in the upper echelons. It still appears in the textbooks. And it will for some time. It'll gradually work its way out. What do you think about that? Well, my question is, if it was so scientific for 40 and 50 years, how could one skull destroy it? The answer is, it was a creation. The basic scheme, the thing that had to be thrown away was, it was the kind of thing that happens when you start out with the philosophy and determine that the evidence is going to fit the philosophy. And it makes the evidence of Homo erectus irrelevant. The Java man and the Peking man, for all their scientific significance, whether they're reliable evidence or not, whether they're fraudulent or not, or whether part of it's fraudulent, or whether the dating is correct, it makes no difference anyway. They're out of the picture now. Understand? Because it didn't fit the scheme. It came along with the finding of a single skull. And you see why it would do that? In other words, all of a sudden you find a human skull several million years before anything like man could ever come along, according to the scheme. So this is a question mark here. This fellow here, he's represented by these skulls here, the Swastikam skull, the Panishavad fossils, and some others, the Ehringsdorf fossils, won't get into them. This, you notice how he is taller? You go down like this. Now they put a beard on him. And the reason they let him grow a beard is to hide something. To hide the fact that morphologically he belongs right here. It represents a class of fossils that you seldom see pictured. You will see the Java man, the original Java man. Of course, they found other skulls later, but you will find skulls in anthropology textbooks, the high school and grade school level, which were reconstructed from just a little bit of the jaw, perhaps a little patch of the skull at the top, cranium. You will never find, I've never seen in them, the evidence of the Fanashavad fossils, for instance. And you had complete skeletons in stratified layers, easily datable. The problem is, they are like modern man, yet they're before Neanderthal. They are pre-Neanderthal. Got him in the right place. They let him grow a beard so he can't see for the fact that he looks like this fella, Cro-Magnon. These, they got in line, do not belong in line. These are simply men. Pre-flood man, I'm convinced, this classification here, they're contemporaries. Right? They do not belong in an evolutionary line. By the way, you can see they're contemporary if you look up here at the time charts. Look at the chart itself. So let me summarize. Here's what you've got. Four that don't belong there. One which might or might not. One missing. This one mispictured. These two reversed. This one a question mark, this one an embarrassment, and three contemporaries. And then you've got man. The only thing that's accurate about this chart is that much. Cro-Magnon man, by the way, who is, this much. Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon, modern man, except the reason I say this is not quite accurate, because you see the difference between Neanderthal, that's the fellow on the magazine, and modern man, see how much bigger modern man is? Absolutely fraudulent. The average Neanderthal man was larger than the average modern man. His brain case was larger. His brain capacity was up to 200 cubic centimeters larger than our brains. His brain case was thicker. He was heavier. He'd whip any one of us and outthink us in a larger brain. But because he's back here, look how he gets pictured. So really, the only thing that's not fraudulent is Cro-Magnon and modern man. Now, what you really have, of course, is you have man, and the racial variations I'm going to show you are no more greater than the racial variations that exist today. You have a question mark, and you have extinct apes. You do not have this progression. It's absolutely, you understand? It is fraudulent. If there was no such thing in the world as a creationist, this would still be fraudulent. And my question, I'm trying to teach you something here, but you understand, I raise the question, why is this kind of thing presented? Why is it pushed by men like Carl Sagan? Who knows better? You see, it's obviously constructed not from a scientific basis. It is constructed for its visual effect, for its propaganda value. There can't be any other explanation. Do you have any questions on this? You see, I've not gone into a lot of detail. Well, that makes me mad. That's very angry. They hand you this stuff and say, what? Don't you want to be scientific? Yes. The question is, are these, I'll repeat it because it's on tape and I haven't been repeating the questions. Are they so blinded by their vested interests? Well, yes, they're blind. I'll tell you two things. Answer your excellent question. First of all, they are utterly convinced. You know, they're utterly convinced that human evolution must be the truth. Therefore, it doesn't bother them. They would say, well, I asked my professor about this very chart. I said, Dr. Jansen, of course, this is fraudulent. He said, oh, yes. I said, doesn't it bother you? He said, well, it sort of gives the general idea. And it's the general idea about which they're convinced. And the fact that, in particular, I mean, the fact that you got four don't belong there and a couple inverted and one left out and contemporary shown as being in an evolutionary line, that's really, the important thing is you understand that something like this evolved into this. That's the important thing. And we know that happened. Therefore, we're not going to be bothered by it because they're convinced. By the way, to be fair, many Christians operate like this. I am convinced that, and I teach church history, and I'm convinced in my studies of church history that pious ignorance and prejudice from within has done more damage to the church than unbelief from without. So they aren't the only ones. You get somebody who's convinced who says, okay, now I know the truth and don't bother me with any more arguments. And that's sort of their attitude. So it's not just them that do that kind of thing. The second thing is, they can't revise this radically for the same reason that the German scholars couldn't redo their theories, their theories of the evolution of the scriptures, the oral tradition and mythology schemes, on the basis of the archaeological evidence. You see, I want you to know something. The world of higher academia is a cutthroat world. Those of you who have been there know that. It's cutthroat. The gentility, generally, gentility often is a thin veneer. It doesn't take much to get through it. They are jealous of departments within universities are often jealous of each other. Scholars are jealous of each other. Archaeologists sit on evidence for 40 years. Will anybody else touch it? The idea that these are all cold, objective academics is simply not true. And you see, the reason that the German scholars didn't revise their theology, the same reason the anthropologists haven't revised their anthropology, is that we're talking about careers. We're talking about textbooks that have been published. We're talking about doctoral dissertations. We're talking about department heads. It's not a matter of it wasn't just a little thing. It's a big thing. For instance, the Germans, this is on the area of theology, for instance, what Albright and the others found in the ancient Near East made the education of many German scholars worthless. You see, you don't get an education doesn't mean to learn a lot. A man doesn't have an education if he's learned a whole lot of what's not so. He just got a generous fooling. My definition, kids, to have an education, you've got to be two things. You've got to learn what's true, and secondly, what's important. A lot of things are true, but not important. You know, important things can be important in all kinds of ways. Did I answer your question? In other words, there is this philosophical, and they are convinced. They're not lying in that sense. But there is this reluctance. I'll give you an example of this reluctance. In cultural evolution, this has really just come out in the last 2 months. Margaret Mead died recently. She was the godmother of cultural evolution. She's the one who went over to the island she worked with, Samoa, when she was writing her doctoral dissertation. She's a young woman. She spent a summer over there, some short period of time. She interviewed them, and she came back and reported this: the Samoan society is perfectly permissive, sexually permissive, and number one, sexually permissive. Number two, it is well-adjusted psychologically and socially. No, very few murders, almost no rapes, very little bit divorce, and people have sex with whoever they want to. Anthropological fact. She made the connection, and it was accepted immediately, because people like that kind of thing anyway. It's accepted. It became the dogma of cultural anthropology for a whole generation. Okay? And it was used, it got filtered down into our dogma, say, well, you know, psychologists were saying, well, Margaret Mead has shown that if we would just let our kids be sexually permissive, they'll be better adjusted. But Margaret Mead never bothered to learn the Samoan language. Didn't spend much time there. And about 10 years ago, an anthropologist from Australia went over there, lived with them for a long time, learned their language, and found out that Margaret Mead had been handed a bill of goods. Number one, they are not sexually permissive. They're one of the most restrictive societies, cultures in the world. Secondly, they're anything but well-adjusted. They have all kinds of murders. To make a long story short, Margaret Mead's basic thesis got blown out of the water. She lost her stature, and that was what made her reputation. What kind of reception has he had? You see, several academic careers have been built on the basic thesis established by Margaret Mead. He has been lied about, slandered. They refuse to hear him. He just laughs about it. He said, well, if they don't want the truth, tell me. He has been unwelcome on college campuses. Harvard very courageously published his book, but he'll go on radio interview and they've undermined him. Why? Well, for the reason I've given. It's a vested interest. And this is what we're looking at. It's an excellent question. Now, that's a general. Now, I'm not saying everybody in the discipline's like that. I stayed under some who weren't, and many aren't. But that's sort of the general picture. Now, let me show you something else in this comparison. And I'm not going to keep you late tonight because we've already lost an hour today. I'm going to show you how this works. And you can see, I just want to give you sort of a general look at comparative anatomy or morphology. Here you can see, by the way, this is how the discipline works. This is just to give you some idea of the discipline, how they compare. Now, this is the skull that made all the textbooks worthless. 1470, Adam. It's a fairly modern skull, but you can see it's before modern man because see the heavy brow ridge. It's called supraorbital brow ridge. That's Latin. It means above the eye. I like the way they do that. Supraorbital brow ridge. Supra means above. Orbital means eye. The ridge above the eye. See how much heavier this is. And you see modern man. See how flattened the skull is. See how round the skull of modern man is. Now this is an artist's conception. And a few look like this. And a few look like this. You see, now that doesn't look like me. You see, if you put that in a textbook, and this goes way back here. This is back 3 million years ago. And this fella is living in the Kiwi Islands. It doesn't have much of a visual effect, does it? They look fairly, with minor modifications, they look interchangeable. But when you put it this way, you see, you can see the difference, can't you? Can you not see evolution? Sure you can. Now that is very, very deceptive. And when you understand? In these charts, when you always show modern man, he always looks like this. And most of us don't look like that. Now, you see almost no brow ridge. What about this fellow's brow ridge? Do you see my point? It depends upon how you reconstruct the ancient skull. It depends upon which modern man you compare it with as to the visual effect. Now, also, and I'll use a chalkboard for this, I would point this out by the way, I talked about, let me point this out, that when they want to compare numerically modern man, they say that modern man, the average, the way they generally, they average, although they also it's quite as simple as this, but basically, they say that modern man's brain capacity is 1,200 to 1,500 cubic centimeters as an average. That's the figure that appears in most books, or something very close to that. Man's brain, by the way, and Neanderthal was in the upper range of this. Neanderthal averaged about 1450, higher than the average for man. Follow me? The average for modern man, 1,200 to 1,500 cubic centimeters brain capacity. Ah, what they don't say is that the range of modern man, not the average, but the range, is 900 cubic centimeters to 1,800 cubic centimeters. Oh, you got that? The average, it averages out around 12 to 1,500. But you can find races of men on the earth today whose brain capacity doesn't affect their intelligence. One of them is an Australian Aboriginal, has a PhD. And it doesn't take much to get that. The range today is 900. I mean, there are races today have average, you know, just with small racial groups, have 900. All the way you can find groups average at 1,800. Well, you see, even if you accept Homo erectus, if we did accept, I don't know that we should or not. It's been so much. Been finagled with so much, you cannot really tell whether Homo erectus, Java man and Peking man primarily, whether these should be taken as evidence. But if you do, they are in the range. If you look up here, I've got this, you can't see this, but the range of Homo erectus is 800 to 1200. You see what I'm doing here? So that if you average it out, now that's probably a low estimate. What we're seeing is that even if Piltdown man, I'm sorry, you're saying, even if Homo erectus, this class, this which seems to have been thrown out, and certainly this, certainly as Skull 1470, they fall well within the range of modern man. You understand? They're simply men. And I would add to that, it's very, very likely that the range, although the modern range is 900 to 1,800, historically the range was probably much, much greater. This is just modern man. I think there's pretty good evidence that if you take the whole range of man, ancient man, the range probably would have been more than 900 to 1,800 cubic centimeters brain capacity. And you find men today of all kinds of brain, of skull shapes. And what they do is they just... And I've dealt with this for years. They take the evidence, these skulls, and they line them up and they select it, you know, for this visual effect. And to say, well, you can see evolution, can't you? You can see evolution if you know evolution going in, and if you arrange it in such a way that evolution... I can take the same skulls and take modern man, and I can find skulls of everything from here on up, and roughly here on up in man, according to their time chart, which I don't accept. And you can show modern men who are behind, evolutionarily speaking, behind them all. I feel like I'm not speaking very clearly tonight. Do you all understand what I'm saying? So, what we've got is, again, if you look at these brains, what we've got is man, even if you admit this, not this picture of him, if you admit Homo erectus, even if you do, not in this form, you've got man, well within the parameters as far as brain capacity, as far as skull shapes of modern man. To label these extinct apes, even though they're not accurately pictured and accurately arranged, to say that those are hominids is simply a label they put on them. You can say these are ancestral to man. How do we know they're ancestral to man? Well, somebody's got to be, and they're the only ones we've got. Now, I don't mean to be unkind again, but that is exactly the structure of the argument. It's easy to say, oh, yes, this is ancestral. But I would point out that if you look at these lines, it looks like a Chinese fire drill. You take the Matrix, Braith and Pilbeam and others, and Philip Tobias and Louis Leakey, and you try to, and they come on, look at this later. There's anything but agreement of where you start, how you go to get to man. Absolute confusion. And then Gould comes along and says, we jumped here, and then we leapfrogged here, and then we got man. Just these magnificent mutations. And so what? And Richard Leakey said, what he did, he just see this heavy line here? This is all the textbook evolution. He wrote, had been for years, he wrote this and said, none of that counts, you just jump straight to modern man. Because what he found was the skull of a man. Now, really, the state of human evolution, physical anthropology, is the state of confusion now. They're trying to sort it out after Leakey's bombshell. But I want us to see something. Now, our time is getting on. I want to say also, there is much evidence that is not here. I mentioned the Shvanashvad fossils, the Swastika. These are pre-Neanderthal, but they're more like modern man than Neanderthal is. We sort of get swept under the rug. There are some others. There are some very excellent. It's interesting. What they do is, if they find something that they can make fit, they can extrapolate from a piece of bone. If they find a whole skeleton intact, in good shape, but it doesn't lend itself to the scheme, they say, well, this is an anomaly. That's a Latin word, means we don't know how this fits in, so we're going to forget about it. I'll give an example of anomaly. Do you realize that human skeletons have been found in what has been labeled in the geologic timescale Lower Dakota stratum? And there's nothing wrong with, according to from an evolutionist viewpoint, with finding complete human skeletons, which never get in any of the textbooks, in Lower Dakota stratum. The only thing wrong with that is it's 97 million years too soon. And because they were so impolite as to show up 97 million years before they were invited, we just didn't let them come to the party. Excellent evidence. On the other hand, you follow me? Why is it that a whole skeletons will not get in the textbooks, but chunks of bone no bigger than a half a dollar will? Well, I think Brace was right. Boy, they have been anxious to prove this. And so my evaluation, after having studied it and been examined in it, is that the general popular presentation of physical anthropology is fundamentally fraudulent from an evolutionist point of view. And I think I perhaps demonstrated that tonight. And I just touched the high points. Now, let me say this. Let me summarize this for you, and then we'll quit for tonight. And I'm trying to skip around and not leave out too much. Well, let me... let me say one more thing, that there is a 40,000-year gap, according to their chart, I'm taking their dates, a 40,000-year gap between Neanderthal man and modern man. Now, I am persuaded, and I'm not going to use the word convinced, because of the very fragmentary and confusing and contradictory nature of geologic evidence, because none of this evidence has been treated the same way, that I am comfortable with the idea that when we look at Neanderthal man, which is this general classification here, who were certainly, follow me, certainly men in the full sense, had larger brains than we did, were bigger than we are, were fully within the range of the present variation, certainly within the range of historic variations, that Neanderthal man is very likely pre-flood man. It's interesting, there's a tremendous gap in the evidence. You have Neanderthal man and you have a gap. What seems to have happened worldwide is you had Neanderthal man, not just Neanderthal, I include Swascom, Fanashavad, the Tsakapa story, the whole classification of skulls, which are men. And then there's a gap in the, seems to be, you know, following, man seems to have disappeared, and then in the repopulation, and the earliest example of the repopulation is Cro-Magnon in Europe. And I think it may very well be that what we have before Neanderthal man are simply extinct apes. With Neanderthal man, we may very well be looking at pre-flood man, then the gap and the repopulation, and then modern man, with no essential difference between Neanderthal man, what they call Neanderthal man, and modern man. You understand what I'm saying? I think it's... Now, that's based upon less than satisfactory evidence. So I wouldn't stake my soul on it. But it seems to make... It makes sense. There's no question whether the flood happened and the man was wiped out. The question is where this fits in. Now, let me summarize for you, then we'll quit. Homo sapiens, in other words, when we look at this, these are simple racial, if I may represent no more racial variations than we have around today, and I've tried to demonstrate that. I've talked about there's meager evidence for Homo erectus, but even if we accept that as evidence, there's no problem. They're well within the range, especially if they have been constructed correctly, which they may not have been. There is the gap after, I've already talked about this, Man has changed. Man has not evolved. He has devolved. He is smaller and weaker than he was. That's simply the following, based on the fossil evidence. And by the way, does not the Bible give us this picture? Ancient man lived before the flood vast numbers of years, lived and bore children for long numbers of years. This is borne out, in, generally speaking, in the fossil record, if Neanderthal man is pre-flood man. How did Adam look? I don't know. I think Adam was probably 8 or 9, 10 feet tall, very likely. I think Gigantopithecus may be a sort of leftover from man's origin. We find this evidence in the Bible. He's called mighty men, and Art and I were talking about this today. I don't know. I don't know how animal-like Adam looked. I don't know how much hair he had on his body. But he was fully man, and he was superior to modern man, not inferior. By the way, that's good genetics. The genetic pool in man is being continually degraded. We haven't seen this so much. Historically, we haven't seen the devolution of man until recent years. What has happened in recent years is because of modern medicine, diseases that used to kill a lot of people before they could live long enough to reproduce now don't kill them. I'll give you an example, sugar diabetes. People with serious congenital sugar diabetes usually died before they got old enough to have children. But now they can live and have children, and sugar diabetes is therefore growing because it's transmitted to many other diseases, understand? And so because modern medicine has allowed man to live and reproduce despite his genetic deterioration, it is becoming visible to us. We're having a higher and higher percentage of defective children, a higher percentage of retarded children, a higher percentage of people born with congenital diseases. For that simple reason, becoming obvious, man is going the other way. The general, and this is my last statement, the general presentation on human evolution suggests, and we haven't got into this, this general presentation, and the one appears in the books, often suggests that the differences between man and animals are only physical and cultural. And that is simply an oversimplification of it. The differences are not simply physical between man and animals. You can have a man I've seen men look very much like apes. They weren't apes. And I've seen apes look very much like men in some of their ways they act. Some of the worst ways. It doesn't make them men. The difference is more than physical. It would not bother me if ancient man looked very much like an ape. It doesn't make him an ape. He's still a man. The evidence is that he didn't. But even if he did, why? Because the difference is more than physical, more than cultural. But the difference, you see, it's interesting. A man and a chimp, and we're going to talk about this tomorrow night. One of the real problems that modern biochemistry which has really been developed since 1960, really, early 60s, is that the chimp and the man, if you take certain chemical sequences, are very much alike. The chimpanzee, man is, you heard this, man is most closely related to the chimpanzee. It depends on which chemical sequence you use. In some ways, man is very close. Man is closer to the soybean, depending on which one you want to use. But in certain important ones, man is very close to the chimp chemically. In fact, he's closer chemically than he ought to be because, according to the theory, and they're having a real problem with this, and I'll go back to this tomorrow night, as I say, as close as he is chemically, why is he not closer morphologically? He should look much more like a chimp than he does, but he doesn't. There's this tremendous gap between a chimp and a man. It's not simply physical. The difference between a man and a chimp is not simply the relation of face size and brain case or comparative brow ridges. Only man dreams, plans, writes music, speculates, works in the abstract, jokes, sympathizes, makes computers, thinks toward eternity, infinity, worships, devises systems of ethics and aesthetics. He has art. Only man is in the image of God. Are there any questions? I'm going to stop tonight. Some of you have been with us all afternoon. Yes. Lucy is right here.
Now, Lucy really isn't important at all. Well, the reason Lucy was supposed to be... By the way, Lucy...
Your picture, you see the picture, you can't tell that Lucy was this high. The reason Lucy was important, theoretically, it is important if you take this scheme, is that Lucy taught us something. She was she was a knuckle walker, probably. That is, her arms were as long, or at least she swung, her arms were as long as her legs. And yet, her face was amazingly, was shaped more like a human face. The skull was shaped more like a human skull than it should have been in the case of an animal that had evolved no farther in its arms. Does that make sense to you? That is, it was supposed to be very instructive because, you know, because of the shape of the skull was more like man, because the arms were too long, so it showed an advance. You know, that's why Lucy was important. However, I didn't mention the same problem. It wasn't that important. You see, one of the problems with Australopithecine, they talk about these are just apes. And the dentition, I didn't get into this too much, the dentition, the shape of the jaw, the flatness of the skull around, they got a real problem because they found in Ethiopia a living ape that is shaped just about like these. Its teeth, it's the comparative, in other words, without going into detail, they found a real problem putting this as ancestral to man because they found a living ape in Ethiopia in the mountains. It is basically structured like this. Well, if he's structured like that, how can he be ancestry? Follow me? He shouldn't be around. He should have evolved out of existence if he was in the chain, in the line. So that's why Lucy was. But Lucy was just an extinct gibbon-like creature. Interesting. For instance, you understand what I'm saying? Because her head was shaped more so much like man. I would point out, but again, that's not all that important. You look at the chart here. I put this on. I put Oreopithecus on here because Oreopithecus gets mentioned but not drawn. Oreopithecus is what they call a Miocene ape. Oreopithecus right here.
Would you like to come along?
That's okay. Oreopithecus.
Next time I come to
church, I'm going to choose equipment.
Okay, ready? Oreopithecus, right here, doesn't get drawn very much because it belongs way back here. The Miocene ape, they call it. The problem is, if you look at the shape of the skull, it should be way up here. Very small. But it's shaped, and if you look at that, it's shaped, got a flat face. And if you look at these creatures up here, they're anything but a flat face. And they found a living one. They found there a living ape, which is much like this. So you got living apes that are like this, and one that's shaped much like man is way down here, you see. In other words, you can say, well, that's ancestral to man. Why? Well, because I say it is. That doesn't make it true. There is not this nice, neat little order that this suggests. Understand? By the way, if you notice, Oreopithecus, there is better skull evidence for Oreopithecus here than there is for Diopithecus. I'm sorry, here. So why did Diopithecus get in the line, even if he didn't belong, and Oreopithecus not get in line? The answer is because the shape of his skull was put way down here. Even though he's small. See, you gotta be very special monkeys to get in this room. Get on the road to Homo sapiens. Not just everybody gets on the road to Homo sapiens, which is roughly on the road to man. I'm sorry about knocking that down to be starved off, but thank you very much. Now as I stand here with my charts and patterns. Are there any more questions? I'm serious. I mean, if you have a question, I know that.
Is it true that different races have different skull formations? And so,
roughly, that's not a lot more broad variation between races.
And also, what you're saying is, before Neanderthal from Indian, you're saying
Unless that's probably because of flood, different times, but most animals are extinct. Very few are left, compared to those which have lived on Earth.
And the extinctions aren't much, you can draw a chart, it wouldn't be difficult at all, draw a chart to show that the extinct days are not all that unlike modern days. Or I have not been accurate using the term ape, really the term is pond, but ape is more particular. Pond is the general fact. Pond is the pond.
I use ape.
Yes.
Where are you? The chart there is the man with his tail.
I don't know if you ever, you notice he doesn't have a tail on the chart. No, you see, he never got it. Man never had a tail. Embryonic recapitulation notwithstanding. They used to say, embryology recapitulates ontology, or ontology recapitulates philology. Not philology. Philogeny. Philology is the study of words. that's still in some of the textbooks, but nobody has believed that for 30 years. The idea that the human fetus reproduces the stages of evolution with gill slits and all that's simply. In fact, that has pretty much got out of the textbooks. Finds minor references once in a while, but that is working its way out 30 years late. Yes. Well, I don't think that'll ever happen for the simple reason. It's interesting. I mentioned that Jay Gould went down to Arkansas, troubled himself to go to Arkansas to make sure that creationism could not be taught in the schools. And I've appeared before the Seminole County School Board in Florida to try to get both taught. Didn't get very far. You see, what they're doing now is a concerted effort that what they have not been able to establish scientifically, they're trying to establish legally. They will see to it, well, they've already done it. They have done is to make it illegal to teach anything else in most states. Well, that's very medieval. I was debating Jim Hooper, the president of the ACLU, at this meeting I was mentioning with Rollins College last year, and he was saying, well, we want academic freedom, and therefore we only want one view taught. I was there accused of squelching academic freedom. I wasn't trying to get evolution out. I was trying to get creation in as taught as an alternative scientific alternative, because there's a great body of scientists who are creationists. They say, no, it's a religion, can't have it in. That's what the Supreme Court said, no, it's a religion, can't have it in. It's a bad decision. But anyway, no, it's established legally. Well, so when he said that, I said, well, that's a very medieval way to do it. I thought he was going to have apoplexy right there. That's the word they always use on us. I knew that. The devil made me use that. You see, this creation, that's a lot of medieval superstition. I said, that's a very medieval way to approach it. The Roman Catholic Church didn't simply outlaw any other view than their views on things. It's interesting. I have this question. If creationism is such a silly idea that only a retarded jackass would believe in it, then why not let it compete in the academic arena and take its chances? The reason is, you see, that if you put creationism up against evolutionism and talk about science, what is experimentally reproducible and hypothetical, deductively probable, never mind. If you get into that, evolution comes looking out pretty bad, and they know it. Why do you think there's such a strenuous effort? Why would they care if the teacher took one day out and said, now this is the creationist argument, this is the creationist view, a couple of days? If it's so silly, can't want the students to be able to see that? They don't want that taught. So the idea is, it's interesting, I got an article, I think I may have it with me, I don't know if I do or not, but the Bible, one of the Bibles, one of the important periodicals of among educationists, the Chronicle of Higher Education, you probably get it. This article came out so many months ago, written by an anthropologist, said, advising evolutionists not to debate creationists. Don't debate them. The number of reasons they gave, the first reason was, you're going to lose. Why? They always do. By the way, you realize there's been some major debates between creationists and evolutionists. And the creationists always lose. I mean, sorry, the evolutionists always, and they lose badly. It doesn't take very long. So now the advice is don't debate with them. Then they said they know how to manipulate the media. Kind of like Carl Sagan. Talk about manipulating the media, you know. They don't play fair. So just don't debate them. Well, interesting. So what they say is we don't want to debate them. What we're going to do, don't debate. This is the policy now. It's well confirmed. Don't debate, legislate. It's like the medieval Roman Catholic Church. That's why I'm not very optimistic about our chances. In fact, let me share this with you. This is personal. This is one of my minor victories. I get a few, I don't worry about this. Believing what I do about the nature of the world, the nature of the devil, and the nature of the gospel, I expect to be in trouble anyway. And the fact, we'll take our licks and not get too upset about it. As Peter said, don't act as if some strange thing happened to you. But if my information is correct, which I've got from the Family Forum in Florida, which is there's an organization called Family Forum in Florida that makes it their business, among other things, to review textbooks and simply advise school boards at the local level and the state organization, which I don't know how it works in here, but we have an organization, a committee, I don't know what they call a commission, I think, in Tallahassee, that puts together an approved list of textbooks, and all the local school boards must order their textbooks from that approved list. Is that how it works here? No. Well, it's not in Florida. Florida has, as I understand, a state approved list. And so what this Family Forum does is it simply analyzes and reviews books and distributes these reviews to local school boards and to the Tallahassee so that the school board members can see what's on the list and say, we think this book ought to not be included in the textbook list and then give the reasons, which I think is fair in a free society. Simply give the reasons. Well, they asked me, and they've never had a book thrown off the state-approved list. They've never succeeded in doing it except for one. My information is correct. I'm the first one in the history of the state of Florida. I don't know how long they've had this. Maybe not very long. To ever get a list. I got a book last year thrown off the list. It was a high school anthropology text. And since that was my field, they asked me to. And so, this is very interesting. And so I wrote a selective analysis of this book. I've got it with me, if you'd like to see it. About a 6-page, or if you're going to, selective analysis. I went through the major, thought was important salient points, and analyzed it through the whole thing. And I presented, I said, number one, it's bad science. Number two, it's outdated. Number three, it's philosophically prejudiced. And it's also got some bad history in it. Now, the book was standard. The book was nothing wrong. As far as books go on that subject, what I found in it was exactly what I knew I would find in it, and what I would find in several other books if I got a hold of them. Finally, it was just the standard presentation. It wasn't anything unusual. It's interesting, and I demonstrated that the book was scientifically unreliable, outdated, in terms of the Godfather evolution, and a couple other things, and they threw it off. Interesting. I didn't appear. I just, wrote it up and sent it up there. The Family Forum took it up there. They were just elated. They never got one thrown off before. Now, the interesting thing is, I did not quote one single creationist. Not one. I simply quoted other anthropologists. And what I did was, the reason the book got thrown off is that when you handle it that way, you got the gap between what the Godfathers are saying and the textbook presentation. And I simply, I cited the experts in the field and showing how what was being taught was outdated, unscientific, unacceptable, and a few other things thrown in on the edges. Isn't that interesting? Now, by the way, let me say, I do not misunderstand my position regarding the public schools. I think the public schools do a great job laboring under some of the problems we've got to labor under. I find that I have never had anything but good experiences with school teachers. I've had nothing but good experiences. I have 4 children. 2 have finished all 12 years. And I have never had anything but fortunate experience with public school teachers. I'm on their side. But they are, in this particular area, they are bound by certain restrictions, and they're bound by certain textbooks, at least they are in Florida. I don't attack school teachers. I attacked the textbooks. I sent the author of the book, since I'd probably cost him $30,000 or $40,000 in book sales. I sent him a copy of the review, thought he'd like to read it. And he never answered me. I thought he might take me to court. I'd have loved that. We'd have had a lot of fun with that, but he didn't. But because nothing was, I did not say anything, it wasn't absolutely true. And I documented everything. Now, isn't that interesting? I didn't have to bring out the creationists' big guns, as you could. I just shared that. I hope you don't misunderstand my saying. I'm not boasting. I'm not boasting, but I'm just saying, I'm just sharing some joy with you. Because, you see, we are winning a few once in a while. But again, the problem we're facing, to go back to your question, which is an excellent question, we're facing legislation. We have nothing to fear from the free exchange of ideas. But when you have laws passed, then they sort of load the dice against you. But that's the general pattern, I'm afraid, across the country. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Well, yes, there's several. There are even textbooks been published for California that were used for a while. You know, if they're still being used or not. Do you know if they're still being used? I don't think they are. You don't know? I don't have them with me, but I've got examples of them. That information is available. There are good books available. I just can't recite them now. I can make book lists available to you. Sure, I can too. Any other questions? I saw a hand over here. Yes.
Your major area is
No, my major area is ancient history. Anthropology was a secondary field. It's called a cognate field. Oh, yes, yes, it is. Well, I had the advantage. I had read a lot of books before I went. Did I answer your question? Yeah. It meant I knew the questions to ask. Because I had an agreement with the professor going in. He's a real fine man. Remember I said last night, evolutionists are not evil people. They're just the general, the godfathers, some of them are not too honest. But not dishonest in the classical sense. They're just convinced. They play with the truth. They play with little truths because they're convinced about the big truths. I went to him. And he served on my committee, the doctoral committee. I went to him and I told him who I was, why I was there, what I believed. And I asked him before I want to know is study you to make sure I understand the discipline. I didn't study cultural anthropology. It's human evolution, physical anthropology. And I asked him, would he accept me as a student on that basis? So the way it works in the program at Miami was you had to take. Are y'all interested in this? In other words, you had to have the way our program worked was, you had to be examined in five areas, four and write in two areas on examinations, candidacy examinations, and write a dissertation in one area. Four of the areas had to be in your department. Mine was history. My major area was ancient history. I wrote my dissertation in ancient history, which really ties into this a lot. But then you had to be examined in a field that was related, called a cognate, that was related to your dissertation area, but not in your department. Well, ancient history, or human anthropology, was related to ancient history, but it was from the anthropology department. So I went to him, and I asked him, that I wanted to make sure I understood the issues and the data, And would he accept me on that basis? And he said he would. The only thing he would require of me was that I understood the material, which is, you know, and he, being the gentleman that he was, he kept to that. 100%. And he served on my committee, examined me, you know, my examination, my candidacy exams. And he was, I had that advantage. Now, if he wouldn't have done that, if I couldn't have trusted him or wouldn't have thought I could, I'd ask somebody else. But most professors aren't like that. I mean, most of them are like that. I find that the ones I worked with are real gentlemen. You got to be careful with a few snotty ones, but I just steered clear of them. I found out, you know, you're smart, you kind of survey the landscape before you march through it. And I just, I kind of scouted around. You've done this, I'm Chuck, and you know what I'm talking about. You kind of scout around and find who might be a potential friend, because you get some guys against you. I had a friend of mine who's from a non-instrument church. He went through the same thing I did, and he got one guy against him, and he had a miserable time of it. He just made a bad choice. He picked the wrong fellow. But then the guy wasn't fair. You'll find a few professors at that level who will attack you on the basis of what you believe. Not very many. You will find those often at the undergraduate level. They're more likely to jump on your faith than they are at the graduate level. That's how I worked it out. He said, that's fair enough. That's all I'll ever require of you. And I think he enjoyed it too. Did it bother me? Made me mad. No. You don't do that. But he was a man of honor. And when I graduated, I told him, I said, well, I want you to know that I believe it less now. I believe it less going out than I did coming in. He said, that's fine. But you see, he was honest too. He's the one who, as I said, like, who said it's a faith. And I think he appreciated our relationship. I found this that, you know, it's, anyway, that was how it worked, if you're interested in that. Oh, yes. As much as many other things are. Well, anthropology is a valuable science. For instance, cultural anthropology has much to teach us in the area of missions. A very valuable study in the area of missions. It's not an illegitimate. Physical anthropology is a little bit built from an evolutionary, and some of the cultural is too. It's like when you separate the wheat from the chaff. Christians have nothing to fear from the truth. Either Christianity is true or it's false, and it's true by the same rules as anything else is true, or it's not worth giving our life to. And so I don't, but see, the problem, let me say one thing to you. I hesitate to, since you brought this up and I answered your question, let me say this, because we've got young people here. I do not advise students to casually enter into graduate programs in this area. I went to it. I was already 30 years old when I went into it. And I had studied the subject systematically for a lot of years. In other words, I knew the questions to ask. But you see, if you don't know the questions to ask, you can get taken in. That is, you see, something might be very false, but if you have no way of knowing that it's false, it may come across as true. So I cannot in conscience not advise students to do what I did, understand? Because I do not know what background, what your temperament is. So don't do it on my word. Don't say, well, Brother Chambers, he said it's a good idea, go do it. That's not what I'm saying. I do not want somebody's blood on my hands. Understand? I didn't just waltz into it as a kid. A lot have gone into it as kids and lost their faith because they didn't know the questions to ask. And it's like anything else. Does that make sense to you? So don't. Now, that's not true of every area of higher education. It's true. It'd be true of this area. Remember I said last night, evolution is very convincing. If you start on the inside and stay on the inside, you're going to be utterly convinced. Because it's so very complicated. It's designed to do that. Much work. It's circular. It's a tautology. According to the, I don't want to get into that. But anyway, I didn't start on the inside. I stayed on the outside and asked the questions. interesting. My professor asked me, I was a creationist, he was a fine man. He asked me many questions I could not answer as a creationist. For every question he asked me that I couldn't answer as a creationist, I asked him 10 he couldn't answer as an evolutionist. Now, what I would do is I would ask him, when it got to the point where it began to get embarrassing, I'd stop asking questions because we were playing in his ballpark. You know, and he treated me like a gentleman, and I treated him like a gentleman. But when I could start him down, if I could see where we were going, then I would just drop it because I'd already made my point. I had a commitment to him, too. And he knew exactly what I believed and what I didn't believe. But again, I do not know if a student who might say, well, I think I'd like to do that. I do not know that you would have the background to know the questions to ask, so I don't advise it. It's very dangerous. I once was an evolutionist. And it is very convincing. Other questions? Yes.